His sawed-off Ishmash 12-gauge double-aught gun snugged in its holster beneath his unwashed left armpit, his Mini-14 riding in a sheath strapped to his Fat Bob gas tank, Hogan, late of New Berdu and Chato's nameless army, made his leisurely break for it. He rode at a walking pace down a knife-blade canyon, actually a cleft split out from the side of a mesa, so narrow he could stretch out his long arms and almost touch the striated sandstone walls with his fingertips, in case he wanted to fall over. His big sled wasn't really made for cross-country work and was none too stable at this pace, but he didn't dare crowd it any faster. Since making good his escape from the goat screw the attack on the armored train had turned into, he had been hiding out on top of a mesa 20 miles to the northeast. It was getting warm up there, and he was getting low on water. It was in his mind to split back for the coast. Odds were his erstwhile bros had cooled down a bit in his absence. Or with any luck, they were all dead. Whatever. He'd had a bellyful of the desert and the weird-ass crazies the man encountered therein. At last, he reached the bottom. He hit the accelerator. The open road beckoned. As he charged out of the cleft, a black, leather-clad arm chopped down over his ape-hanger bars from the side and clotheslined him neatly. The big bike rolled a few more feet and toppled over.
Thanks again, Farwalker.
The little one and the rest of his tribe were miles away, but Ryan reckoned the little shaman could hear him right enough. Despite his refusal to guarantee accuracy of any of the prophetic visions Ryan had received on their shared spirit journey, this one had panned out just right. Ryan hauled the bike upright again. He had to be careful, his clavicle was still sore, and the banging he'd gotten from the armored bear hadn't done it any good, even though nothing had gotten broken. He forked the tiny saddle and rolled back to the fallen rider, wheels crunching in the sand. The biker raised his shaved head. Ryan kicked him in the temple, but not hard enough to break his neck. The cold heart subsided. Ryan dropped the kickstand, dismounted, and walked to where his own traps waited behind a bush. He pulled the biker's panniers off the rack over the rear tire, dropped them to the ground, then lashed his own pack in their place. The one-eyed man drew the Mini-14 from its sheath and threw it onto the half-conscious biker's chest. He slipped his own Steyr SSG into its place. Finally, he took an extra water jug, a clay pot with a basket woven around it that could be soaked with water to keep it cool by evaporation that he'd brought from the Little One's settlement, and tossed it to the sand beside the prostrate biker.
Sorry, bub.
Ryan swung a long, lean leg over the bike again, gunned the engine, and was gone in a swirl of dust. Taos. Paul and Christy coasted, gratefully resting their weary legs, down the last grade toward the ville.
That place is one of your bigger villes between the coasts. It's a rendezvous for pilgrims off the plains, as well as the mountain man, woods runners, cold hearts, and all the other curious two-legged fauna that range the rocks. Old Baron's notorious for welcoming anyone, man or mutie, so long as they got jack or goods to pay for their stay.
They had pushed hard to make the prophesied rendezvous, Paul seeming as driven as she. Unlike the earlier stages of their journey, in which they had been following Magog directly, they'd encountered frequent breaks in the track. Strangely, these worked to their advantage. While Magog had to stop at every break and wait for repairs to be made, it was easy enough for Christy and Paul to portage the Paul Yaw to intact line. If necessary, they could even take off the baffles that held the little craft to the rails and pedal to the next good section on its bicycle tires, which had solid cores themselves and never went flat. Mad and obsessed he might be, but Paul was a certifiable genius as designer and builder. They rolled around a hip of a mountain cloaked in tall ponderosa pines and saw the ville then. The usual straggle of shacks and reclaimed ruins dominated a sprawling, multiple-storied adobe structure like a combination fortress and apartment block. Christie's heart gave a quick pulse. Magog was here.
Looks like you done it, Missy.
She smiled at him through sudden tears.
We did it.
Don't remind me.
They stashed the yawl in the ruins of an old motel outside the current limits of the ville. Christy twisted her hair into a knot and covered it with a cap she'd taken from the dead deserter. Then she shouldered her pack and M16, and she and Paul walked the rest of the way along the track. On their approach, she had noticed strange platforms dotted along what seemed to be paths into the ville. Although no one appeared to be watching the tracks, and from the way weeds grew up alongside and between the tracks, obscuring them from view, she judged that here as elsewhere, people paid them little mind. But beside it stood a tall pole with an outsized wagon wheel nailed to the top of it, like a piss-poor attempt at a windmill. With a start, Christy realized there was a twisted, half-mummified corpse attached to the wheel. On the other side of the track stood a more conventional gallows pole with a partial skeleton, still clad in the faded and tattered remnants of a frock coat, dangling from a rope. Christy turned a questioning look to Paul. He shrugged.
I should mention he welcomes anybody as obeys his laws, as well as can pay. Brutal but fair, the Baron of Taos.
Numb, with a sense of almost floating unreality, Christy pushed her way through the throng of gawkers and sekmen toward the great gleaming train. The bracing mountain air was freighted with the smells of unwashed bodies and pinion smoke. And worse, apparently the Baron focused his mania on law and order at the expense of considerations such as a working sewer system. Paul trotted at her elbow, pale and drawn.
Paul, how do you think the Baron feels about this general and his rail wag?
Baron's a realist.
Paul was doubly glum because even from a distance it was obvious the general had set sentries on the ground and atop the cars to discourage the curious from getting close enough to touch Magog. They hadn't had to shoot while Paul and Christy were watching, largely because no one doubted they would in the first place.
Guess he reckons an armored train with the firepower to level his old Ville, ice down all him and all his sec men, all their relatives and everybody in the whole wide world so much as looks at him, all without working up a sweat, can pay its way, sort of by definition.
There's something I still don't understand. I've been wondering more and more why more people don't use the rails. The fact the lines are mostly forgotten doesn't quite seem to explain it.
Well, it's one thing to travel light, like we've been doing and the technomads do, with vehicles and goods that you can portage past breaks. It's another to carry enough goods to make trade pay. That's why the technomads deal in services and little gadgets. The general now, he has unique advantages.
They had almost reached the juncture of the line they had arrived on and the one which Magog had followed down the Grande Valley from Denver. The great lead engine gleamed in the morning sun. Paul paused and wiped a tear from his eye, overwhelmed.
He's got fusion power and carloads of pre-war supplies, plus plenty of manpower and the means to get more. And he spends half his time stopped to fix the line. Which is, after all, why we caught him.
Better we split here. Won't do you any good to be seen with me.
You sure you know what you're doing?
No. Only what I have to do.
Wait.
He flicked furtive glances up and down the narrow, mucky lane, then stepped back into a noisome, narrow alley. She followed him warily. His hand fished in the pocket of his coat and came up with a heart-shaped locket on a silver chain.
Here. Take this.
Why, Paul, how sweet.
She opened it. It contained a portrait of a handsome woman in a high-collared blouse, painstakingly hand-painted in miniature. It looked as if it were decades old, not centuries. Not a survival from pre-dark days.
Thank you. Who is it?
Nobody. Never mind. What's important is this.
He reached out and tapped a tiny stud, barely visible, on the left-hand lobe of the heart-shaped case.
This'll call any technomads within a 20-mile radius.
He shut the locket, then pressed another button on the right lobe. A tiny red light began to blink from the top.
That means there's technomads within 20 miles of here. Friendly ones, at least to me. Gotta be cautious with strangers, though. Not all those tales you hear are false.
He shut off the light. She paused, staring down at the locket.
I can't take this and leave you with no way to contact your friends.
Why, Missy? Whatever makes you think that's the only way I got to reach him? I told you, I'm a gadget kind of guy. Just naturally tend to collect them, even when they don't got anything to do with trains.
She smiled and slipped the chain around her neck. Then she leaned forward and kissed his cheek.
Thank you, Paul, for everything.
She started to turn away. He caught her by the arm. She swung back, surprised. Other than the choking incident, it was the first time since they had met that he had laid a hand on her.
Chill him. Bastard defied the most beautiful thing I've ever seen or ever will see. Spreading slavery, death, and misery, all in the name of doing good. Chill him.
Yes, Paul. I will. Time to reload. Deathlands is continued on the next CD.